This week on The Breezy Breakfast, we examine human rights and equity in education. Our guest, Alicia Ralph, is a dedicated advocate for human rights and equity. She brings her experience in education to her new role as the Human Rights and Equity Advisor for the Upper Grand District School Board. Alicia addresses many topics, including gender and sexuality, equality and equity, and the concerns of parents regarding school curriculum. She uses her personal experiences as a parent and as a passionate supporter of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms to inform this discussion. Today's breakfast was moderated by Phil Ault.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another Breezy Breakfast. My name is Phil Ault. I am a city councillor in the city of Guelph, and for the past six or more years, we've been bringing you these delightful breakfasts from downtown Guelph, where we discuss community events. I am very happy today to say that I am joined by a number of educators, including the chair of the board of the Upper Grand School Board, Ralph Messenbrink, who is here as well representing the board. And we are also joined by Councillor Aaron Caton, and those are all the political officials. We are also joined by many activists within the community who have very much to say. And with that, I am going to turn it over to Margaret to introduce our guest.
And then once I introduce our guest, so our guest today is in a brand new role. The role is Human Rights and Equity Advisor of the Upper Grand District School Board. And our guest is Alicia Ralph. Alicia is a dedicated and passionate advocate for human rights and equity, bringing her experience in education to her new role as the Human Rights and Equity Advisor for the Upper Grand District School Board. It is a new role, and her goal is to address human rights and equity for students and staff, promoting system-level and organizational transformational change throughout the Upper Grand District School Board. Alicia is a social worker, and she is currently completing a doctorate degree at University of Western. Born and raised in the region of Peel, Guelph is a new city to Alicia, and she looks forward to getting to know the Guelph community and the wider community, which the Upper Grand District School Board supports.
Thank you very much, Morgan. And Alicia, welcome to Guelph. Before we go, I would just like to do our statement of acknowledgement, which has just been recently approved by the City of Guelph. And this will take more time than normal because I think it's important that not only do we hear it, but we hear the explanations as well. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us toward reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. This place we call Guelph has served as traditional lands and a place of refuge for many people over time, but more specifically, the Anawandaran and the Haudenosaunee. The land is held as a treaty land and territory with the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation. Guelph lies directly adjacent to the Haldimand Tract and is part of the long-established traditional hunting grounds for the Six Nations of the Grand River. Many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples who have come from across Turtle Island call Guelph home today. And I'd like to extend thanks to all of our staff, to the community, and to the various First Nations advisors who helped us to frame this statement, and I'll just go to the explanation. The first paragraph provides the context that history does not start at the point of European contact. It establishes that the lands where Guelph is situated had a rich history, culture, and governance structure, which existed long before settler contact. It encourages us to reflect on our responsibility to care for the land and resources for both present and future generations and how we can move towards reconciliation. The second paragraph recognizes our treaty partners, the Mississauga of the Credit First Nation. It also better represents and acknowledges the traditional use of land. It strives to better balance the recognition of Indigenous nations who have considered these lands as traditional territories and reflect on the complex histories of the place we now call Guelph. Thank you to everyone who was involved in reframing this statement of acknowledgement. May we keep in our hearts and in our minds those who have lived on this land for millennia, and those who often struggle as a consequence of many natural disasters that in some senses are caused by the settlers who have come here and have taken advantage of the forests and the mines across this great nation and have maybe caused unintended environmental consequences for those who live still in very similar fashions to manners in which they lived 1,000 years ago. And with that, Alicia, welcome. This is a great place for you to be. We're glad that you're starting your day here. Hope that you will come and join us many times. I'm just wondering if you might want to outline for us some of the work that you do, maybe even outline what your day and your week are like, and how we can perhaps become more involved with issues of human and civil rights as they affect us, not just as parents, but as members of the community.
Thank you so much, Phil, and I'm so glad to be here. So good morning to everyone who is joining online. So, you know, my day is, it's sort of sometimes scheduled, but unscheduled as well. So it's really dynamic in terms of what the needs are. And I would say in terms of how my role is, it's more around building the capacity, because I think sometimes we get a little bit nervous when we hear things like human rights, but it's more around sort of the day-to-day building of capacity for everyone to understand what their role is in upholding human rights. So that could be working alongside our senior team, as well as working directly with our teachers and our school communities, so that everyone has an understanding what their roles and responsibilities are in terms of protecting human rights, as well as thinking about what equity looks like and feels like and means within our schools and our workplaces throughout the Upper Grand.
Well, thank you very much. Now, a couple of terms that you used here, I think, are really important. Building capacity and nervousness about human rights. Honestly, I will state quite clearly, I'm not nervous about human rights at all. I think human rights are very fundamental to us and address many of the concerns quite neatly, as long as we apply those lessons. What do you mean about building capacity and being nervous about human rights?
Okay, I will start with the nervousness. And I think that comes with a new role where my whole portfolio is around human rights. And where I think that creates nervousness is this fear that, you know, me coming around is like an extension of the tribunal, meaning that I'm going around looking for human rights violations. So that's what I mean when I say sometimes it creates feelings of nervousness. When it comes to building capacity, I would say it's more about sort of building the relationships with staff and the community. So there's an understanding of the roles and responsibilities. So what does that mean? That means it could start from, you know, breaking down what human rights means. It could be giving some guidance. And it's more around being accessible to have conversations for folks to ask questions around, you know, things they may not know or need clarification of in terms of human rights and equity. So yeah, that's my, that is the nervousness, and that is the building capacity piece. But I think the most important thing is when we're thinking about building capacity is that not everyone has 100% knowledge of everything. It's a continuous journey of learning. I'm learning about the Guelph community and the larger Upper Grand community that our board serves. So, you know, I think that we just have to understand that we all have the capacity to learn, and it's an ongoing process. And that's the thing that we have to commit the most, because that's where change happens when we think about where our learning needs are.
Change happens. I think that's an incredibly important term. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about change right now. Now, it strikes me that oftentimes people are afraid of change. How can we communicate to people that change is a positive thing? We've seen many changes in front of us. We've had to deal with some instant changes as a consequence of things such as COVID and the closing down of many of our public institutions. We've had to address the need to accommodate many. What can we see as being positive about change within the school system and within the community from your perspective?
Thanks, Phil. So I think when we think about change and positive things about change, it's important to realize that change usually helps address something that maybe historically hasn't been addressed, right? So change is like, I would compare it to basically like when you're gardening and you're pruning and you're, you know, looking at your roses and you're making way for a better, what would you call it, like a better next year gardening season where all your roses are coming to bloom. It's the same thing of how I would see change. So change is more around sort of giving growth and giving room to things that maybe we didn't before. So when I think about it in the human rights context, I think about maybe historically how folks may have been treated from a human rights standpoint, and what change would look like is basically given room and space for folks to be treated and have access to resources, knowledge, and tools to be able to be successful. And I think that is sort of a basic thing in terms of change, is basically allowing everyone to grow and become, you know, who they want to become in terms of their pathway. And I think that's a part of one of our slogans is find your path, which is basically what growth is about, is helping folks find their path and be able to grow into them.
Thank you. That's an interesting slogan. I can appreciate it. Originally, my path was social work, and I discovered that my path was not social work, but was rather history. And I think that those paths are very important. I think we understand many of the traditional paths that we presumed existed within education. Somebody could be a doctor, someone could be an electrician, someone could be an auto worker. But I think in the education system, there have been many situations where we have not necessarily been open and cognizant to what we now recognize as fundamentally important. And I think I'm just going to start with a couple of terms and then get perhaps into some gender issues and perhaps some other issues as well associated with change and also associated with finding your path. So the first thing, many people confuse two terms, and I was wondering if you could help us understand equity and equality. What is the difference between equity and equality, and why does that matter?
Thanks, Phil. And that is usually my one-on-one course in terms of understanding the difference of equity and equality. So I would like for everyone to maybe imagine, a pizza. From an equality perspective, you'd be giving everyone a slice of pizza. And, you know, really thinking about what that means in a household. I have three boys. If I give everyone a slice of pizza, it's equal, but some folks are still hungry, especially my son, who's 6 feet two. So when we think about equality, it's really around, equity. It's really around giving folks what they need, right? And that could be, it could look different. It might, from a pizza slice perspective, it might be a half of a box, right? In terms of what you need to feel full, or, you know. So when we think about equity and equality, I think the difference is equality is just giving everyone the same thing. So there's no discrimination. I give everyone the same thing. I treat everyone the same. And with that sort of definition, it's not really realizing sort of historical context of unfairness and how that maybe created different outcomes for individuals, especially in education. And when we think about equity, it's really about sort of stepping back and thinking about, okay, if we treat everyone equal, there's still folks who are not able to reach their potential or find their path. So from an equity perspective, what do we need to put in place so that everyone has a chance at finding their potential? And I like to think of it as, really thinking about, like, not a race, but giving everyone the tools to need to be able to participate in the way that makes them feel successful. Some may not need anything, and that's okay. And some may need other tools and opportunities and access to resources so that they're able to participate in the same way as others. And that's what I would frame equity as.
Okay, thank you. Well, the issue of equity is interesting to me. And I just want to go back to the good old days when I was in high school at GCVI. Back then, I don't think we understood equity. And so when it came to learning skills and trades, if you were a boy, you might end up in machine shop or auto or woodworking. And if you were a girl, you might end up in typing or in home economics, learning cooking or sewing. And I regret that. In some senses, I'm a little annoyed about it, because your analogy of the pizza is really important. Most of my friends who were boys never learned how to cook a pizza. And so consequently, never knew how to share that pizza as well. And I was wondering, could you please comment on just some of the more obvious changes that have allowed for equity and access just for males and females within the school system.
That's great. And I was probably one who would want to go to CHOP and then go to cooking class. So I totally read that totally resonates with me. In terms of sorry, I forgot your question because I was focusing on your CHOP.
How have we changed so that males, females, everyone can find their path?
Okay. So I think the first thing is starting to think about what that path looks like and not thinking about defined categories, right? Thinking really around when, especially when we're talking about students, what their needs are, what their likes are, and really starting to think about maybe historically who hasn't been included. So like when you refer to the CHOP class, taking a real hard look at maybe historically who hasn't been there and why. And then when we think about sort of changes, it's more around wrapping around supports for students so that they're able to find their path. And even when we think about that, that can have different outlets, because I think sometimes even historically finding your path would be like you have to go to university and that's it, right? But I think more and more we know that finding your path may be going to trade school. It can be becoming an entrepreneur after finishing school. So really thinking about how we see things differently so that we're able to support students to find their pathway in ways that is not maybe gender specific, race specific. It's just around sort of what the students actually want, need, and desire.
And I think that that's very important. Just one area that comes to my mind as you said that was the number of males that became nurses over the last 20, 30 years. When I was in high school, there wasn't a chance that a male would ever be encouraged to enter nursing. And similarly, females were not necessarily encouraged to become doctors. And thankfully, that has changed a lot. We need males and we need females in both doctoring and nursing and in all the different professions associated with healthcare. And from that, I want to segue because I think that we also need to recognize that there have been challenges with gender and gender identity lately. And so as a consequence, last week in Guelph, I wasn't here, but there were two rallies in downtown Guelph associated with these issues. How do school boards address LGBTQ++ issues within the educational system?
Thank you, Phil. And I'm aware that there has been some recent conversations about equity and gender identity within our schools. And I think what's important to know is that, you know, this is about human rights when we think about sort of basic rights. And from a school board perspective, there's really been no changes in terms of how we support our students in our school environment, despite media attention and things that may have happened over the past few weeks and months. Our stance is really around supporting our students to find their path, to be successful, to feel a sense of safety while they're learning in our environments and be able to what is probably described and I describe as well as be able to come to school as their authentic self and be able to thrive as such. So when we think about the LGBTQ+ community, it's an equity. It's about the same thing, helping students find their path, helping them feel safe, supported in our school environment, and supporting others to have the knowledge and the courage to help uphold and support our students and create that sense of safety and belonging within our board. And that goes for our staff as well.
Let's unpack that a bit more. One of the issues that I've heard frequently about is the misnomer, misrepresentation, parental rights. And I really struggle with them. And the reason I struggle with them is my belief that human rights are inalienable, regardless whether you are a child or whether you're an infirm senior in a long-term care facility, you have the same rights. And yet I'm hearing people talk about parental rights. And I contrast that with parental responsibilities. I was wondering if you could just unpack that a bit, because I'm struggling with the issue of what is a parental right? Are there parental rights? Or is this a misrepresentation that has become part of our common vernacular that we should perhaps obliterate?
Thank you for bringing attention to a really important understanding of human rights. So there is no such thing as parental rights, just because I think that's what it speaks to. Parents or guardians, they have responsibilities entailed in their role as a parent, right? this morning I had to get everything ready for my kids before I came here, which was quite early. And that was my responsibility, right? There's things that I don't get as a parent in terms of rights. I don't get to choose what my children want to do. I can encourage them, but I don't get to choose things for them. They are their individual selves. And when we think about human rights is around the individual rights. It's nothing to do with the parents. Everyone has an individual right. And I like that you talked about or contextualized it from a senior who is living in a nursing home to a child who was born yesterday. Each individual has individual rights. There's no, I cannot forfeit my rights and give them to my parents or anyone else. They're individual human rights. And I think that's the important thing that we have to understand. And as parents, parental rights really only applies, I would say, from Revenue Canada perspective, when you're thinking about things like maternity leaves and things like that. That's where we talk about parental rights. And I think there's where the confusion lies. Yes, you are a parent and you have rights. So you have the right for time off when you have a child. That is a parental right. But in terms of the actual power or ability to make decisions for your child, like things like pronouns, I'll say it out, that's not a parental right, unfortunately. Well, not fortunately. Well, fortunately, it's not a parent right. Thanks.
Okay. Well, then the question then becomes, I've heard of many people, and I've been retired for 9 years, who are concerned that perhaps students are being brainwashed about gender and sexual identity issues in school. And I noticed that we also have said the chair of the school board, Ralph Mezenbrink, who was a principal as well. And I might drag him in to comment on this as well. But what is this thing about brainwashing children and forcing issues of sex ed down their throats at various stages of development?
Thank you. That is a very important question. And I think the thing to really think about is there's really been no change to our curriculum, meaning that despite what you may hear or around you or see in the media, there's nothing new. So there's been no directive from our minister around changing the education our students receive, right? So that is an important part of clarification. And in terms of our students, I forgot your question. Oh, goodness.
Many people are concerned that schools are apparently brainwashing, indoctrinating, programming kids.
Okay, so there's no indoctrination happening, right? And I think these are strong words that are being used in inappropriate ways to, you know, to really gain attention to things that are really non-issues. When we think back to finding your path and what equity looks like, this is things that we are been doing and have been doing within our school system and of itself. Opportunities to affirm the identities of our students. And what does that mean? That means that we're providing space so that a student all across the human rights spectrum, or, you know, they're getting to understand how they are represented with. And I'll use my personal experience as an example. Historically, I may have not seen people like me in a textbook, right? And, you know, what we're learning is that for me to feel a sense of safety and belonging and even thinking about my own path, it's important to provide opportunities for me to see people like me in different roles and responsibilities and you know, through literature, through examples, so that it helps me find my path or help me find my path. So it's the same thing I would think about education. It's more around helping affirm the identities of students, right? Because we want to help them find their path. And really creating that sense of safety and belonging, right? So that is what the goal is from an education perspective, is to create safety, a sense of belonging, and to affirm the identities rather than maybe historically where folks felt like they had to hide their identity. So it's celebrating the differences that we talked about earlier and really ensuring that students have the opportunity to be their authentic selves. And that happens through the curriculum when we tailor the curriculum to supporting that difference. And difference is good.
And what Alicia means by that is people don't often see somebody who has the charm, the poise, the grace, and the confidence that she displays, along with a PhD. I mean, I'm sure that's what you meant. And I do want to pass it over to Ralph, but Ralph wishes to make a comment from the perspective of public policy, governance, and the Board of Education.
from my own experience, one of the most important things that happens in schools is what it was you said, keeping our students safe, ensuring that they feel welcome, and ensuring that they can see themselves in the curriculum. That has not changed over the past several decades. When people talk about new curriculum, as Alicia said, the last time the curriculum pieces that have anything to do with gender identity were updated was about 5 years ago by this government. Nothing has changed since.
And thank you very much, Ralph. I really truly appreciate that. I think it's important that we do hear from elected officials on issues like this and to understand that we do have input into them as a community. But there are some things that perhaps are more in the realm of mythology than reality, as Ralph and as Alicia both said, there have been no updates. We are dealing with the same issues as we've been dealing with for many, many years. And with that, I do want to segue, and I want to deal with the race issue. Alicia, quite clearly, you're coming from the African-Canadian diaspora. And from my perspective, being a very clearly white male, I probably have a different experience in education and in society than do you. What are some of the issues that we should be addressing when we're dealing with students of color, regardless where they come from? And that would include students that are clearly identifiable just by how they dress or even how they worship.
Thank you. That's a very important question. And I think it starts with a few things. I think it's number one, by addressing bias, right? And bias, everyone, that's another word people get scared of when they think of bias and what that means. And I think when I think about what different groups of our students from a racial perspective, part of the work is, again, when we think about building that capacity, is addressing that bias, because we all have biases, right? And that's okay to have biases, but what's more important is recognizing that we have biases so that we're able to interrupt how they impact the way how we connect with others in a teaching perspective, how we respond to our students in front of us, and even from a workplace perspective, how we treat our colleagues. When we think about race also, it's important to understand sort of historical and current data. And I think that's an important thing when we think about that pizza and that equality versus equity around it, really thinking about historically how individuals, specifically Black, Indigenous communities have been treated within the education system and how that has led to different outcomes for our students. So that's important when we think about data perspective. And luckily, school boards, including ours across Ontario, have been collecting data around student identity, which is important. It's so important. And I know for many school boards, there was a little apprehension to collect identity demographic data. But it's so important because it helps tell the story of what are we doing or what can we be doing more to support that equity for our students within our system. And when we think about that, that might be looking at specific supports and programs for our students so that they're able to find their path and they're able to be successful. And I think when we think about race and the historical context of our education system, I grew up in a time where I heard teachers say, I don't see color. And it was sometimes a statement that went over my head. And what I always say is when a teacher or somebody says, I don't see color, right? I don't think it's coming from a place of harm, meaning they're saying that, you know, I want to treat everyone the same. So the pizza equally, right? But what we're not seeing is, again, the importance of equity, the importance of being able to see people as who they are, and to affirm their identities and make them feel comfortable in spaces such as education. Right. So when we think about historically, there's things that we know that we needed to do better in terms of creating opportunities for our students. Right. And that can be even realizing that the needs of our Indigenous students are different from our other student population, as well as our Black students. And, you know, coming from another school board, you know, really being able to create programming that is responsive to the needs of specific groups. So in the board that I was coming from, we had a graduation coach for Black students, and everyone was like, why would you need something like that? Right? Is that segregation? Like, why do Black students need a graduation coach? Right? And I think part of my role there and hopefully here, would be around educating folks around the historical context of why someone like a graduation coach may exist. And we do have an Indigenous graduation coach at our board currently, and it's the same lens. So it's affirming the identities of our students. It's creating safety, right, for students to find their path. And it's to build capacity for other folks who may not be Indigenous or Black to understand, you know, what they need to know in terms of supporting their students. Because I would think that every teacher, or would hope, or most teachers, they get into the profession not of race politics or any politics, it's around serving students. So with these roles and supports, the goal is to build that capacity to be able to support students. And that, what I would say, is important within our school system.
Thank you very much for that. I'm going to carry on with that for a bit, because I think you've raised a very important point that I never would have imagined, was the issue of a graduation coach. Is there, off the top of your head, are you able to cite any statistics or trends about graduation based on culture, ethnicity, and other aspects that I might not be familiar with?
Sure. So maybe I don't have the percentages, but no. what I do know is that historically, Indigenous students and Black students specifically have experienced some of the lowest graduation rates. So, you know, I think that's important context when we think about equity and what your schools look like, what programming looks like, what supports look like, is understanding that historically there have been students, I don't want to say been left behind, but have been left behind in terms of their education. And we know, as much as folks here sitting here would know, is that your education is an opportunity. It really helps mold what your whole trajectory of life is, right? So when we think about education, it's access to jobs, it's access to resources, it's the ability to understand things in terms of like your rights and how you navigate the world. And it trickles into other systems, like even healthcare, how you're able to access healthcare. Because folks who are from lower income or socioeconomic status groups, they're most less likely to even have something like a family doctor. So you'll see like the education is correlated to health, and is correlated to so many other systems. So when we think about race and outcomes, right, I think we have to think about it historically. Students have been left behind. And from a future perspective, from a moral perspective, that, you know, when students are left behind, right, they have negative outcomes with other systems as well. And I would always say that education is at a unique vantage point, because in education, we're able to actually change the trajectory of a student's life. And I'll give you an example. At my other board, I had a student who just came from Nigeria. She was a new immigrant, came as a refugee. Navigating the school system, did have no idea. Outcomes, did not know what her outcomes in education would be, right? But by thinking through the lens of equity, what that means in terms of supporting not only a student who is Black, but also a newcomer and navigating a new system, she was able to actually get, with support, $100,000 scholarship, Loran scholarship, for her to pursue her post-secondary studies. So now we just changed the trajectory, or could have, would have, or maybe a trajectory in one student's life. So I want us to always think about, you know, this is not just something when the student doesn't graduate, it's not something that sort of leaves after those 4 years at the school. It impacts the community, it impacts your community, it impacts the safety of a community, it impacts the health of a community. So that's why it's also important to think about when we're thinking about equity, sort of not just today, but what happens tomorrow.
$100,000 scholarship, that's no mean feat. I'm hoping that maybe we can get together with that student sometime, because we will not have to share the pizza. I am sure that there are chicken wings, or maybe some darn good groundnut stew on the menu that we can share for that. I want to deal with the safety issue, and I want to deal with it from the perspective of mental health and wellness. I suspect that you are addressing many issues that are, in some senses, associated with race and gender and human rights that we would identify as mental health issues as well. Could you comment on that, please?
Right. So, interestingly enough, I am a social worker by trade. I think Morgan was able to mention that. So when we think about equity and the work that we're doing as a board, it is heavily tied to mental health, right? Because when we think about creating the safety for our students, that means protecting their mental health and well-being, right? So that's really thinking about even what supports look like. Like recently, we had an Indigenous social worker hired for Indigenous students. And could you imagine how important it is to have someone who has the lived experience, a historical understanding of, you know, issues you may have experienced, you know, being Indigenous, and now you have that resource to talk about your mental health and well-being, right? There's something invaluable about that. So when we think about mental health and well-being, I think there's two things. We're always thinking about mental health well-being for our students, maybe three things. We're thinking about how we continue to protect our well-being of our students. How do we deal like with things like last week when we had the protest around really thinking about what safety looks like for our students from the LGBTQ plus community, as well as thinking about how do we build, again, that capacity for staff and educators and trusted adults to understand what their roles and responsibilities are in terms of protecting the mental health and well-being of our students.
Actually, you know what? I actually have an agenda in front of me, but this is going so far off agenda, and it's so great. I'm not going to stick to it. The roles and responsibilities are fairly important because oftentimes I do hear people say, teachers at the school have no right to teach my kid blank, 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 and blank. Teachers have no right to be interfering with the family and so on and so forth. What are the roles and the responsibilities of educators when it comes to the issues that we've been talking about? And let's run the gamut, everything from mental health to issues of sex and sexuality to issues of racial discrimination and bigotry. What are the roles, responsibilities of those people in the educational system to ensure that human rights are protected for everyone?
Thank you. So I would say the number one responsibility is to ensure as an educator, as a trusted adult, that you are actually upholding the rights of the human rights of our students. That's the number one responsibility. The number two is really creating that space within your classroom, within the curriculum, with through engagement, even thinking about how and who we engage with as parents, to support outcomes for our students. So that is the responsibility as well. I think there's always that responsibility of learning as well too, because we don't know everything. And I want us to understand that we might not all know everything. We may not know every community. We are dealing with lots of growth within the area and areas that Upper Grand serves. And nobody has like a atlas of knowledge for every student identity, as well as different cultural identity that students may have. So part of the role and responsibility as a teacher, I would say, is forgetting about sort of coming in with a predefined agenda. We have curriculum to support that, but really thinking about looking at the students who are in front of you in your classroom, thinking about what you see and may not see, and thinking about how you can be responsive to create opportunities to affirm identities of students, as well as create knowledge, and I would say almost a critical awareness. And when I mean critical, I don't mean being critical, but just having more knowledge, right? And asking questions and being, what do I say to my kids? And being, well, they ask a lot of questions. Just being really passionate about learning about other people. And I think that's what the teacher does in the classroom environment.
Let's go to something that I think for many educators is fairly important and is sometimes difficult. And that's the duty to report. And the contrast of that with confidentiality. If I am a teacher and I have a student in front of me who alleges that, say, they were a victim of gender-based violence, what is the educator's duty? And what are the issues of confidentiality? And let's flip it. If a student comes out to me, do I as a teacher have a duty to report that to their parents, especially if they're in a religious environment that where there might be repercussions that are negative?
Thanks, Phil. So again, going to the human rights, there's no parental right. And that even goes from educators' perspective in terms of how we communicate to parents. And I think when we think about that situation you described, where there may be a child who or student, you know, who confides in a teacher around their gender identity or expression, the role, it doesn't, it's really unchanged. And I want folks to understand that. So the role is to support the student in terms of, again, feeling that sense of safety and belonging within that environment, right? Accessing any supports that may be needed to support that student. Because can you imagine that reality of almost living two lives, of, you know, being able to be your authentic self at school and at home being someone else? So you can imagine the supports that would be required to support that child. And again, from a human rights perspective is, you know, these are the individual rights of the students are our priority, meaning that there is no space or room to misgender students, to not hold up their gender expression or identity, or even disclose. That's actually a human rights violation. So when we think about our parents' roles and responsibilities, I think what we need to think about is that for many students, right, they live in very loving homes that are supportive. And for those students, it's a no-brainer. They're able to go home and be their authentic self and feel supported. But for some students, they may not be. And that's why we have policies in place to support students so that they are safe, right? And, you know, this is all at the consent of a student. We have to remember. So we gave students their individual rights. They have their individual rights, and they have the individual right to consent around how they want to disclose information, right? So we have to not only hold up the human rights, but also what a student consents to. And that's an important term to understand, because consent is something that needs to be made explicit, meaning there's no assumptions, there's no miscommunications, no intention versus feelings. It's around explicitly, right? And then that's the conversation where parents may come into place, is if there is explicit consent to disclose such details to parents. Otherwise, our priority is maintaining the confidentiality, really respecting the dignity of that student to be able to be successful in that school environment, and providing those supports around, if they need them, around how do they navigate things like, you know, coming out to parents or disclosing information to their loved ones.
Thank you. And I actually had an experience actually in my first year of teaching, which was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, where I did have a very, very solid student of mine. She had just come from Pakistan, and she wore the hijab. And she said, you know, I feel very comfortable with my family. It's very loving. But there's one issue that I can't talk about, and that's my sexuality. And I think that what's really interesting is that sometimes we create a dichotomy. There are good homes and there are bad homes. What about the homes in the middle? We're clearly loving on all sorts of issues, but then there are those issues we just don't talk about.
And that's important, right, in terms of that middle ground. And I think that's more around where we, as we think about, again, what does the student need? What are they communicating that they need, right? How are we creating that safety in that school environment so at least they're able to feel supported and their human rights upheld within the school environment? I always say sometimes we cannot change the dinner time talk at the table, right? But what we could hope to do in the school environment is to have students be able to show up and be able to, of course, achieve their goals from an education standpoint and feel supported and safe in doing so.
We've got a couple of questions, I think. Morgan, question?
We were talking about equity in healthcare as well as education and how the two are linked together. Something that a lot of parents aren't aware of is once your child turns 15 and a half, they're no longer permitted to have any information about their medical care. So how does that kind of thing, when someone is, you know, 15 and a half, they are deemed by everyone to be old enough to look after their own medical care. So when it comes to the question of age and being able, being, you know, having enough world view to make consent, How do you address that kind of thing when a parent comes to you and says, my child isn't old enough to consent to anything?
Thanks, Morgan. And that's an important question and a thing to highlight from a human rights perspective, how age relates to this. So when we think about human rights, age relates to usually only housing, right? That's usually the only ground where we think about age as ability to think about things. And that's usually at the age of consent, which is 16. So age of consent is usually around healthcare and it's around housing. That's the only thing it usually extends to. How we deal with that issue of consent with parents, right? In terms of what a feeling, again, there's nowhere in the human rights code that talks about an age of consent for human rights. Like I said earlier, human rights, you're born with human rights, right? You're born with human rights. So there's not really an age that, okay, human rights, we turn it on at 16. It doesn't work like that. Human rights turns on from the day you enter the world. You have human rights, right? So when we think about consent and the confusion around that, I think too, when we think about systems, it's a little bit different from a healthcare perspective and a human rights one, right? Being able to consent to surgery is different from being able to consent to not sharing my gender identity with my parents.
And I think that's a very important point that you just raised. From the moment we are born, we have human rights. Just a point that up until about the 1830s in Canada, a child was not considered a human until they were 5 years of age, approximately, because they did not have the capacity to survive independently. We've come a long way from that, and I think that we're perhaps all grateful for that as well. But I'm going to change a bit because I have Councillor Caton on screen, who has dealt with a number of challenging issues associated with education in the past, and I think has got a very good handle on some of these. And Erin, if you could just perhaps ask or state your concerns, that would be great.
Hi, thanks for being here. And I appreciate the fact that your job exists. So I'm a non-binary parent, and my daughter has a couple of different disabilities. So a lot of this applies to my family. And one of the things that I've had to do kind of over the years in terms of trying to get human rights met is dealing with disability accommodations for her schools. And it seems to be a little like it depends on the school board. It depends on the school as to kind of how quick things are handled, because she has sensory issues and autism. So there's a lot of new information that comes out, and a lot of people aren't really that up on all of the details, as well as we've got kind of gaps in the provincial legislation around things like scented products and what other kids can wear versus, you know, how that's handled when your child goes to school. So I was just wondering if you could kind of speak to how parents can request accommodations. And because I know, like, for myself, I had to go all the way up to the Ministry of Education during COVID because she has reactions to alcohol hand sanitizer. And so there was conflicts between public health measures and her accommodation needs and things like that. So it became a little bit complicated. But if you could speak to disability accommodations, I'd appreciate that.
And just be very mindful that we are being very, very careful not to identify any student. Erin has very clearly identified a daughter, but we have not mentioned the name.
Thanks, Erin, for your comments. And I think I empathize with navigating, because I do have a four-year-old who is on the spectrum, and I totally understand in terms of, from a mom perspective, what that looks like in terms of navigating through systems for access to resources and accommodations and what that needs to look like. From a perspective of a school board, I think what we need to consider is, of course, that we need to support the student. And I think from what I've seen, I've been here maybe 6 weeks now, is I will say, coming from another school board, I have seen a model in place that's really around centering the needs of the student. And it might look individually based because each individual student's needs is, you know, different. And I think I can appreciate that model is it may not look the same because every student's need is different. But what I can appreciate is the flexibility of the model. We call it the SCIP model. to be able to support what the accommodation needs of a student is in our system. And I think I'm like, you know what? Part of my academia brain is like, we should do research on this, because to me, this is revolutionary. When we think about what parents, you know, are asking for their students or advocating for their students specifically with needs, because sometimes it gets lost in the conversations around equity, right? We talk about different kinds of equity, but sometimes we forget around what does equity look like for our students, right? And I think when we think about the school system, right, you know, we have SEAC, we have different ways of how we look at equity, how we think of what equity looks like for our students. But more importantly, I think there is some room to build capacity and awareness. And why I say that is because for many parents, they don't even know how to navigate to get supports for their child. Yep. And when we think about even layering it from an intersectional lens of race and socioeconomic status, it's even worse. When we think about access to resources and identification and early intervention, you know, it's really important to consider how different intersectional identities of a student can impact that, what that looks like, how that feels like, what is seen as being a need for accommodation, what is, you know, what is advocated for, what is ignored, et cetera. So I think as a board, we always can do better. And I think through our SEAC and our SCIP model, I think we're on a good pathway to figuring out systemically, you know, what does equity look like for our students with special needs or disabilities? And, you know, what is our responsibilities in terms of accommodating their human rights? Because you do have human rights as well from a disability perspective, so that our students who have needs are able to find their path as well too. And in a few months, we'll hear about some programs that will be in place to support students. Because I always say, like, a pathway for a child with special needs, it may look different, but it's a pathway, and we need to support students on their path. And when you think about our students and I think about their pathway, right, like, what does that look like? And traditionally, when we think about tradition and historically, how have students who had disabilities or special needs been treated in systems like education? And how do we make that change and that shift to really think about how we see our students? Before, they had only like Section 23 classrooms where kids were isolated and not able to participate in education, right? And there's been a shift. But also, where do we shift in the classroom? Because I would say sometimes some of the ideologies continue to exist around potential of our students. And being a parent and an advocate as well, in terms of that similar experience, you know, there's always more work to be done, because, you know, we need to be able to support our students who have disability and special needs.
See, I've got three people, and I want to thank Morgan for opening it up. I'm going to go to Susan, Ron, and Tanya for questions. But just a comment about navigating. One of the things that I, as a child of very poor working class parents, experienced was the actual incapacity of my parents to navigate anything because they were too busy. They just couldn't do it. And I think your comments, perhaps about the biases of the education system, need to be taken to heart. We are not all equal within the education system. And it could be a class issue. It could be a race issue. It could be a gender issue. And those are things about ourselves that are so fundamental. We will carry them around all of our lives. And related to that, you mentioned Section 23 schools. Some of us know what those are. Others don't. Can you please identify what Section 23 school is, why they exist, or why they did exist, because they might not exist anymore, and what we're doing instead?
Okay, so I don't want to date myself in terms of age, but, you know, as a social worker, that was my first experience with the education system, is seeing what this looked like. And some of Section 23 classrooms were provided by the Ministry of Children and Youth Services. And what they were basically schools set up for students who had specific needs, behavioral, whatever the case may be. They were basically separated, sometimes bused for miles away from their home schools to be in these centers, right? And I don't have a visual, but I have a visual in mind. I don't know how to describe it. These schools sometimes looked different, felt different. We're not like a classroom setting sometimes the way that we think of one. Because of how students behaviors were, I will say, framed or managed. So basically, students were separated from the actual mainstream system. And when we think about this, you know, I'm a social worker by trade. So when we think about this historically, from a mental health perspective, this happened as well too. When we think about historically how folks with mental health were treated, they were not allowed in the community. They were separated, institutionalized, kept separate, and not able to access the community. So when we think about it in the context of education, imagine being separated, institutionalized, and not able to access the wider community, the impact that has on your pathway, on your sense of belonging, on how you feel connected to your community. So we've changed and we've come a long way, but it wasn't that long ago. And that's just a reminder in terms of the work that we're doing around equity is some of these inequities, they continue to exist, and where we are working to change, it wasn't that long ago.
If memory serves me, in Waterloo, perhaps in Wellington, Lutherwood was a Section 2023 school, if I remember correctly. I'm just going to go to Suther.
For 31 years, I was a teacher librarian in the high school, and now I work in the Guelph Public Library. And of course, most people may have read last week's headlines about Peel school libraries and all books before 2008 being removed, regardless of the books. So I have a great concern about resources offered in a school. So I wonder if you could comment. I know you're not in Peel anymore, so you don't need to say anything about that. But about that kind of approach to taking things out that people don't approve of, even if there's only one sentence in that book.
Well, thank you so much for your service as a librarian. I think you, when we think about librarians, they're so special in regards to their roles within schools. Yeah. Right. They're so special because, you know, when we think about knowledge and curriculum and access to knowledge, sometimes that's through books. And when we think about, again, like affirming the identities of our students, sometimes it's flipping a page of a book and seeing yourself, right? And what that looks like. So I will say that I don't think we've had an issue of pulling books at our board. That's not been an issue. So, you know, but I think what we need to really think about, again, is impact. When we think about knowledge and dissemination of knowledge and impact of a student around how we use resources, right? Are you resources used in a way to educate, or are they creating discomfort for our students? Because if you can imagine some of the literature years ago around how we portrayed our LGBTQ plus communities, right? And when we think about the school context, we are trying to get educators to affirm our identities of our students, to create safe spaces of learning. There's a responsibility to ensure that when we're using material, that it's not contradicting that. So that's what I would say around how we use resources to ensure that it's still promoting what we see as the basis of our roles and responsibilities to support our students, that it's consistent with that.
Thank you. And I'm just going to pass the mic over to Ron.
First, I'd just like to applaud both of you, Phil, for being forthright and addressing the issues directly, and Alicia for responding incredibly well. I want to applaud both of you. And I'd just like to ask, I mean, some of these issues are incredibly controversial. And I'm really curious, when you've talked about rights, you've talked about the rights of students, and you've talked about the rights of teachers, and you've talked about the rights of even school boards. But parents don't have rights. They have a role, they have responsibilities, but no rights, especially with young children. So I would really like to get a comment on, is that actually your position, or is there some middle ground in there?
I think that's a good question, Ron. I think quite often the challenge is that we kind of confuse rights with our roles and with our obligations. And I think perhaps we can get some greater clarity on that.
Yeah, that's correct. So rights is not, it's unchangeable. It's not, you can't change it. There's no question or theory about that. The responsibilities might look different, as we talked about consent, as we talked about helping kids navigate through systems. Here's where the responsibility factor comes. there really isn't a middle ground, because if we have a middle ground, then we're negotiating human rights, which human rights are non-negotiable. So we can't really think of it as a middle ground. I think we need to think about human rights as protecting the individual. It protects our child in the event that we're not even there to protect our children. I'm here. I'm not able to protect my children's human rights right now, but our systems are supposed to. Our folks, our individual teachers are supposed to. So parents, you know, we are a part of the equation in terms of the role and responsibility, but our individual rights don't extend to our children. They have their own individual rights. So I know sometimes as a parent, it's like, oh my gosh, what do you mean? Like the child has rights. I have rights and I don't have parental rights. Yeah, correctly. You just as you have rights. I'm just trying to think of if my parents thought they had rights over me now as a grown lady who lives in her own home, how difficult that would be, right? Meaning I have my individual rights. My parents have their individual rights. My children have their individual rights, right? And we respect individual rights, but then we think about our role and responsibilities. My parents are retired. I have roles and responsibilities as a daughter, right? Helping them navigate what that looks like for them. But I don't have any rights, right? To them or what their decision making, unless they make me power of attorney or something, that's different. What you're thinking about the middle ground would be is how do we support our students to be able to have conversations with their parents around their individual rights?
And I think just to add to that, I think what's very important for us to appreciate is that teachers, anybody within the educational system, anybody within the medical system have limits on their behaviors. Those are prescribed as a consequence of a profession. So, in other words, remember a long time ago, anybody who taught 45 years ago, you were discouraged from going into a bar in the community in which you worked. Now that we have got that right back, so we can come to Breezy Breakfast, have a coffee if we want. But there were clearly certain behaviors from which we were excluded. And that was as a result of ensuring the rights of students. And I want to get to one, before I get to Tanya's question, I want to deal with the issue of reproductive choice. Because within the school system, we often come up against that issue. Reproductive choice, where a student might say, I'm thinking of going on the pill, or I'm pregnant. And I think I need an abortion, or I think I might have an STI. And these are all real examples that have come from my experience. What are the responsibilities and what are the challenges for educators in those situations?
First of all, Phil, I think you could do a Netflix series based on your experience and all the things that you've experienced.
All teachers have had them.
As an educator. But I think, again, we have to not conflate different systems in terms of how they're at play. So the healthcare system is a little bit different from the education system in terms of rights and responsibilities and things like that. But I think as an education or educator or education system, the role, again, is promoting the safety of the student, protecting the confidentiality of a student, because, again, they have individual rights. And that is sort of the role, right? So, you know, in terms of navigating, it's really around, again, centering what the student's needs are and navigating and helping them connect to resources appropriately to make informed decisions and not using our own ideologies that we may have around choice and what that might look like. It's around providing resources to help them navigate versus then make decisions for students. Because they still have their individual rights, even reproductive ones. Yes.
And thank you for that. I have another question that is associated with the health and safety of the student. And that's one that deals with eating disorders. If a student were to come to you or come to anybody within the educational system and confessed that they were bulimic or that they were anorexic, that they didn't want their parents to know about it, that strikes me as a safety of the individual issue. How does someone like yourself deal with that?
Again, I think that is something different from human rights, right? In terms of where we look at human rights and where we look at individual rights in terms of safety and health. And what I'll do is I'll compare it to mental health, because that's where my background is. When we think about mental health, individuals have the right to have mental health, but if their right, if their mental health puts them in a position that impacts their health and their safety, then there's their rights. I don't want to say they're taken away, but we think about what supports are needed. So we have things like the Mental Health Act that help really support folks who have individual mental health needs. And that would, I don't want to say trump human rights, because it's not trumping it, but it, I would look at a way or a pathway in regards to helping protect the individual's right. So it's not a workaround, but it kind of is, because someone who has a mental health difficulty, there's a different urgency around or who's bulimic and could be at risk from a healthcare perspective. There's a different risk there that we would need to consider in regards to the protecting of the individual's rights, but also around their general safety. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, not a problem. The sharing, we're getting better. We're getting better.
Too much.
I want to thank you for that. And as you were talking, I reflected on Good Samaritans. And it strikes me that in some senses, this is a parallel to Good Samaritan laws, where there is implied consent to actually address a challenge that is a threat to the health and the well-being of the individual, where an educator has a duty to respond, but also a duty to be mindful of the individual's own confidentiality as well. Would that be a correct understanding?
Yeah, similarly, I just want to give you an example. God forbid somebody has a heart attack. We are not focusing on the consent, and we're going to think about first aid. We're going to think about life and helping maintain their life and supporting their health and safety. Mm-hmm. So I would think of it in the same way, where health is completely different than it is. It's different from when we're thinking about individual human rights and how we like disclose something to a parent versus, you know, administer medication to a student who has an allergic reaction. It's quite different. So I think it's important to separate the two, because if we're thinking about rights in that context, sometimes it can confuse sort of what gives you the right to, if that makes sense.
No, it certainly does. And I think it creates a challenge for some people. When a student is living a life outside the home, which many of us did, I know I didn't tell my parents anything. I lied to them about loads of things. Are we encouraging students to lie to their parents when they hide aspects of themselves, whether it's a gender issue, a girl or a boyfriend issue, or are we allowing them to keep their own counsel?
That's a good question. And I think what we are missing is the role that an educator plays in a student's lives. It's not sort of holding the reins to helping maintain sort of that disconnect between the home and the students. It's even around guiding them to resources and conversations around finding out why there is a disconnect in the first place, right? So part of an educator is to probe a little bit more. It's not like, okay, I'll accept that. You know, part of that is the relationship building, that safety in that environment, engaging in with the students, making them feel a sense of safety. And through that, you're able to help navigate, is it a safety issue, right? Is it a comfort issue? And how do you help navigate? There's resources. You have student support services. We have social workers. We have child and youth workers. I think you said you were one as well. You know, to help navigate, you know, around, I don't want to say around, but dealing with these issues between home and school. I don't want folks to think that teachers all of a sudden are walking around and I'm like, I am like a lockbox and I'm just walking around as a lockbox of information of students. It's not really like that. It's more, there's a relationship component around this as well.
I think I'm just going to try to sum all of this up with just a couple of questions. And that deals with your daily work life. Are you the equity police? Do you go into classrooms? Do you check out that everything is equitable and fair and safe? Do you report on teachers? Do you report on students? What do you do? And what would your normal day be like?
Okay. So I am not an officer in no kind of way. And I'm so happy and that there was some intentionality around what I was called when I came. So the role is an advisor. And if you could think of an advisor, you have a financial advisor, right? What does your financial advisor do? They give you knowledge and tools so that you're financially able to come on a Thursday morning and enjoy being here for this show. No, all jokes aside. So my role is around sort of the advising piece. It's working with staff, not working against staff. It's working with our students and providing knowledge and really building that ability to understand the reasons of why we're doing this work. It may look different. It may look different when I'm in a school around addressing specific issues. It may look different in a boardroom where, you know, I'm challenging different issues as well, too. So it's pretty dynamic. And what I would say in terms of my day-to-day role, I'm not walking around with tickets. I am not a human rights and equity officer. The role is around that relationship piece. That's why I'm here today. That's why I look at how I engage with communities, because I always say, like, it's about 10% policy in my work, but it's about 90% the ability to build relationships with others. And when you build those relationships with others, you're able to ask questions like Phil's asking. You know, there's no silly question here. And, you know, I'm able to provide that sense of safety to help build your knowledge or awareness of others' knowledge so that we're able to do the right thing, which is at the end of the day, you know, support our students in a way that promotes their safety, their well-being. And I've been saying, find your path. Oh, my gosh, I think I'm going to get this as a tattoo and help students find their path. You know, that's the business that I'm.
And Alicia, I am so thankful that you're in that business. We really, truly appreciate you being here and appreciate your continued learning through life. As you said, you're completing your PhD right now.
It's a doctorate. I have to work, Phil. I can't do a PhD.
I truly appreciate you being here. And as Alicia did mention, financial advice, she will be staying behind to offer us financial advice as well as other advice. But first, we need to get to Tanya to hear about upcoming events, including, I believe, a good one for next Tanya.
Okay, first, I'd like to hand it over to Alex. Alex has an announcement to make.
Could I just start by thanking Alicia for a wonderful presentation? I just wish that everyone would, no matter what their perspective, would discuss these important issues in such a clear and rational manner. Thank you. So I'm here to talk about National Urban Park for Guelph. A group of local organizations and residents is spearheading a move to create a National Urban Park in Guelph. This presents an opportunity to ensure that part of the natural heritage gem that is the former Guelph Reformatory is preserved for future generations. There are already worrying signs that unless we act now, our enjoyment of the reformatory lands will be lost forever. For instance, historical stone walls are not being maintained by the province and are mysteriously falling down. There are plans to demolish the historical trestle railway bridge across the Armasa Road. The city plans to cut down most of the mature trees along York Road and redirect Clive Creek as part of the York Road widening project. And the city plans to build a stormwater management pond on the reformatory land. Only overwhelming support for preserving public access to this space by making it a park will ensure that we save this special place for our kids to enjoy. The groups endorsing this idea include Yorkland Green Hub, the Arboretum at the University of Guelph, Guelph Hiking Trail Club, Nature Guelph, Guelph Outdoor School, Guelph Urban Forest Friends, Focus on Nature, Guelph Coalition for Active Transit, the Architectural Conservative Ontario, Guelph Wellington Branch, the Guelph Wellington Master Gardeners, Water Watchers, and Rare Charitable Research Reserve. You can show your support for this project by following the link that I've placed in the chat. And signing the petition for the House of Commons. And I want to stress that we are an underdog in this project, and only massive public support will see this realized.
I believe next week we are going to be having Mike Marcolongo speak to us about the after effects of the rescinding of the Green Belt debacle. I don't know that I can put it any other way. For anyone who is concerned about the Green Belt,
and what that means, and also Bill 23, in my opinion. We have miles to go before we sleep, but Mike will provide us with future plans, and I think that would be worth their while. So at this point, I would like to thank everybody for having attended, and I cannot thank Alicia too much. I've learned a ton today, and I hope that others were appreciative as well. Thanks again, Alicia.
Group of local organizations and residents is spearheading a move to create a national urban park in Guelph. This is an opportunity to ensure that part of the natural and heritage gem that is the former Guelph Reformatory Grounds is preserved for future generations. There are already worrying signs that, unless we act now, our enjoyment of the reformatory lands will be lost forever. For example, historical stone walls are not being maintained by the province and are mysteriously falling down. There are plans to demolish the historical trestle railway bridge across the Aramosa River. The city plans to cut down most of the mature trees along York Road and to redirect Clyde Creek as part of the York Road widening project. The city also plans to build a storm water management pond on the reformatory land. Only overwhelming support for preserving public access to this space by making it a park will save this special place for our kids to enjoy. The groups endorsing the idea of a national urban park in Guelph include the Yorklands Green Hub, the Arboretum of the University of Guelph, the Guelph Hiking Trail Club, Nature Guelph, the Guelph Outdoor School, Guelph Urban Forest Friends, Focus on Nature, the Guelph Coalition for Active Transit, the Guelph Wellington Branch of the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Guelph Wellington Master Gardeners, Wellington Water Watchers, and the Charitable Research Reserve. You can show your support by signing an electronic petition on the House of Commons website. Please Google petitions, E as in Echo, 4593. That's petitions, E4593. You can have your say on a variety of city projects: the downtown infrastructural renewal, the Downtown Heritage Conservation District study. There are playground updates where you can vote for your preferred alternative. There's the 200th anniversary of Guelph. And there's the Race to Zero regarding climate change. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be doing a deep dive into the Greenbelt shenanigans with a dash of Bill 23. Our guest is Guelph's tireless Greenbelt advocate, Mike Marcolongo. Future Breezy Breakfasts include an update on 10C, including the farmers market, shared workspaces, and much more. A federal update with Guelph's MP, Lloyd Longfield, and a special spooky breakfast with storytellers Bonnie Dirtnell, Susan Ratcliffe, and the Jay Walker. Thanks to Alicia for being our guest today. And see you next week for a Green Belt Miracle.
That's all for today. Join us each week on the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour, where the coffee is always hot and the topics are even hotter. Music provided by Jules Germ, post-production by Scotty Hertz. See you next time.